there is a space between stimulus and response. And in that space is our opportunity to make a choice. Curiosity is at the heart of that. When we become curious about how we instinctively conditioned act or respond to stimuli, we begin to build stronger leadership, stronger connections, stronger teams, and more effective communication all around.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age, from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Simon Brown, and today I'm here with my co-author, Garrick Jones.
Hello.
No Paul today, unfortunately, but we are delighted to be joined by Salvatore Manzi. Hi, Salvatore.
Hello, it's an honor to be here.
Warm welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast. So, Salvatore, you're a communications coach who works with data-driven tech leaders to help them share their ideas with clarity, with confidence, and with presence. And over the two decades, you've guided leaders through boardrooms, global stages, and high-stakes moments, including coaching speakers at SXSW, the UN, and even a presidential candidate. Looking forward to hearing more on that. And your new book is just out, so Clear and Compelling Communication Strategies for Big Thinkers with Bold Ideas, which brings together that 20 years of communication strategies to help turn data-driven insights into messages that truly inspire and move people. So I'm very keen to hear more, but maybe let's start with the topic of the moment. So what do you feel about curiosity, Salvatore? How would you define it?
Curiosity is a gateway drug. And what I mean by that is curiosity is what creates the sense of connection. It creates engagement, it creates collaboration, and it leads to that sense of wonder, which is at the heart of life and living. I mean, what I think about is a child. I don't know if you have children in your life, but watching a child is such fun because we get to watch their curiosity in unfettered, uninhibited ways. They just go and try and do. And that, to me, is the heart of curiosity, that sense of wonder and infusing life with all of that.
And so your work then sits at the intersection of leadership, of communication and collaboration. So maybe let's go back to the beginning of sort of what took you into that space and what's your background that took you into the world of leadership and communication?
Well, I was blessed to have a father who spoke at conferences and a mother who facilitated group events. And so watching the two of them growing up, I would witness their enthusiasm after any kind of event. And I thought, wow, this is for me. I want to know. I want to try this. And unfortunately, my first time on the stage was a disaster. My voice started to pitch up so high that I actually lost my voice and I had to walk off the stage without any words. Could have been humiliating, but for me, it did spark curiosity in the sense of how did my body betray me? And it sparked a couple of decades of researching neuroscience and psychology and organizational behavior to understand how the brain receives and translates and processes information, how we as in groups of people relate to each other and can translate and communicate those kind of words. And as I kept developing my own tools to help myself overcome what had happened and get better, people started asking me, how do I do this? And I myself am a more introverted person, and when I started doing public speaking training, it was in the San Francisco Bay Area, so I was working with engineers and scientists and data-driven people, and I was like, these are my people, and the tools that I had developed were useful for them, and so that's how I got here and how I kept going, and I love it. I love helping people translate complex ideas and make them clear and inspirational for others.
I'm amazed that somebody who described themselves as introverted ends up in the one profession where you're on stage and you're coaching others and you're right at the front of the room. I mean, it must be courageous at some point, but and you talk about loving it now, but that must have been a journey you've been on.
Yeah, it is putting myself in the fire again and again and again. What I realized along the way, as an introvert, it's actually more comfortable for me to own the spotlight than to be at risk of the spotlight coming to me.
Wow.
So if I take the courageous step of putting myself out there and taking control of the spotlight, I can redirect it. I can direct it to a message. I can direct it to the audience. I can direct it to however I want. But as an audience or a participant in the meeting, I'm constantly, as an introvert, like, whoa, here it comes. It's gonna, they're going to call on me, right? But
yeah,
if I train myself to own that spotlight, I can do it.
You said that it can be taught empathy. And it's interesting to me that you've learned, you know, to own the space and to control it. And then you talked about empathy, and that can also be taught, even to high-powered executives who often skip things, you know, to rush to get things done.
Right.
How do you teach empathy?
I love the pivot to empathy because it is the heart of communication in my work. And in my book and in my work, I teach the number one principle of communication: you, then me. You, then me. If I can express acknowledgement, validation, reflection about you, your world, your situation, your thoughts about the content of what I have to share, before I get to my message, it creates a collaboration. It greases the wheel and creates a conversation. So you, then me. And to your point, what a lot of leaders do, especially in a fast-paced, dynamic environment, is they skip the empathy part. And I learned that you can teach empathy out of 20 years of coaching. I was constantly sent into the offices of people who were getting 360s, that they were not showing or demonstrating empathy. And over time, developing the you then me principle, where they gamify demonstrating acknowledgement or validation before speaking, it develops the muscle of empathy in that person. And I would offer to anybody out there, if you've ever been told that you lack empathy or that you're too rushed or that you're too transactional, one thing that you can do is once a day, challenge yourself to say three things about the other person before sharing your thought, comment, idea, response, whatever it is. Just once a day, develop the muscle of going three deep on an acknowledgement, validation, or reflection about that person or what they just said before getting to your own point or agenda. And you'll develop the muscle, and you'll also develop the reputation as somebody with empathy.
So if I go three deep on what you've just said, I hear that you talking to me about that empathy can be taught. And I also hear that high-powered executives often skip and rush things to get things done. And I think I can relate to both of those. And then you've also said there's a point about the you, then me. If I think about you, then me first, before I ask the question, these help develop the empathy between us.
Right.
How did I do?
Like, Simon, I'll let you. Like, you were listening. What was your, as an outside observer?
And I think it demonstrates you're listening, demonstrates that, yeah, you've taken on board the key pieces and sets up the conversation in a more positive way. So I like it.
Yeah. I'll try not to drop the mic then.
Yeah. Good. Can I offer a little polish? Are you open to polish?
Yes, please.
What I would offer if I were coaching you is, yes, you got to three, which is great. The first two, solid. You started with, I hear you saying, right?
Yeah.
It sounds to me, if I could, those are wonderful pivot points, prompts to initiate. There's a little word that you threw in there that I want to flag, and that is the word but. I offer to leaders that you get one but a day. You get one but a day. That's it. Otherwise, it's no buts. And it comes from the world of improv. I don't know if you've ever heard of the yes and technique.
Oh, yes.
We've had session podcasts in the past with Dan Klein and all around.
Dan Klein, amazing. It took me 6 months to eliminate but as a reflexive word and transitioning from one side to the other. A lot of people go from you then me with a but, and it is smoother and more accessible when it's an and. Even if I'm about to tell you that everything that you just said is wrong, if I can set up with three, this is what I'm hearing you say, this is what I believe that you're saying, and this is how I can see it works in your world, and here's every way that you're wrong. That and greases the wheel, whereas the but negates everything that you just offered. So one thing that I would offer, and you did ask for that, I would say, like, eliminate the but, and you've got a solid mic drop moment.
And this is once a day builds the habit, but this should be something where actually we use this in, you know, every meeting, or is this when is this most powerful, and when should we be looking to adopt this approach?
I would offer to anybody wanting to exercise this and develop this, do it in a low stakes environment. Do this with your partner. Do this with your kids. Do this with your peers in a non-high stakes meeting until the muscle develops. Because in that high intensity moment, it's hard to reach for validating, reflecting, acknowledging before. So develop the muscle in the low stakes. But to your point, yes, it can be inserted into every conversation, every interaction. Ideally, every time you open your mouth, you start with an acknowledgement or a reflection of the other person before getting to what you heard. And that is the essence of that person beginning to feel heard and seen, lowering their defenses. It's a neurological thing. It lowers the defenses. Okay, I don't have to assume that you got it and you just gave me an answer. I can actually feel and hear what you said, and I can either correct or I can feel seen and then listen to your perspective as well.
And what sort of results have you seen from the people that you're coaching with this? How has it transformed, how they've interacted with stakeholders, with teammates, with their partner? What have been the results you've seen?
What I've noticed is especially with data-driven communication, tech leaders, scientists, people who are trying to express complexity to a non-data audience, it becomes a critical moment. And I have, I can give several examples. One that I like to highlight is a woman who was in charge of the data for a very large health organization and was not getting progress on her initiatives. They were being ignored, talked over, and just dismissed. She began speaking the data in different terms and acknowledging what she's hearing to then submit her ideas. There was a moment where she's like, oh, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to ask, how are you feeling? Like, it's that moment of like, oh, yeah, I have to wait and ask you, how is it going? Because as a data-driven professional, she knows that when I'm in the zone, I'm working data to data. And when she's working with her team, it's zeros and ones going back and forth. But when she then pivot to key stakeholders making decisions, they feel a lack of empathy and they don't connect with her. So when she started using the you than me, she started connecting more and she went very quickly from director level to senior VP.
And so maybe coming to some of the other things that you have in your book. So one of the principles, I think, is around dialogue, not download. Mm. So tell us more of, what does that mean? Why is that critical? And is that also for sort of data heavy environments, or is that one you can apply across any environment?
I would apply it to any environment. And the dialogue, not download, is based on the idea that we can only absorb so much information before we need to interact with it, process it, connect with it. And as a professional and an expert in your field, you're going to have all of the data and all of the research and all of the rationale. And if I try to convince you by giving everything to you, but surely if I just tell you everything, then you'll make up your mind and agree with me. It lacks the ability for that person to connect. So dialogue download is the essence of stopping, offering a reflection, offering a moment for questions. I don't know if you call this in your experience, but fireside chat and town halls became the norm. Instead of all hands and our business meeting, they started renaming them with the idea of making conversations more of an interaction and allowing people to have insights from the information rather than just a lecture where you're giving me all the information.
Is that maybe counter to the way some of us default to, I guess, of I have all of this information, this will make a really compelling case. So if I share all of that information on why it is so important or so whatever, that's going to make the strongest case. But what I'm hearing is actually that becomes overwhelming maybe, and stopping, pausing, inviting reflection actually creates a stronger landing of the message we're trying to get across. Am I understanding that right?
I would concur, and a wonderful you than me offering that acknowledgement, reflection of what I just said. You've probably seen this in your own world where people have come to you, like maybe even, do you either of you have children, by the way?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. where they come and they make that case, and these are all the reasons, and da, 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 da. And there's not a lot of reason or logic to it, but like they fail to often see the need to engage you in the conversation to make that pitch. I don't know if you've experienced that.
Oh yes. I get text messages sometimes going, I want something. And it's direct like that. And then there's usually a conversation, well, let's see whether it's going to cost you, but one step at a time. Your book, Clear and Compelling, you've been through the whole process of writing a book, which we have, and it's fascinating and interesting, and it's quite exciting to get it to a point where you can actually convey something. If I had to ask you about that experience and this book, what are the most important things? I know we have to read the book, but what are the things that you really feel you want people to get out of reading this book? What's behind why you've written it and what you want to communicate?
I love the question, but I'm so curious to talk about your experience, because I was sharing with Simon earlier, I did it in a vacuum. I was by myself and I set my own hours. You did it, the three of you. Like, how did you navigate? He said you had like milestones and stuff, but yeah, okay, we'll put that aside for a minute. I'll get to your question. Maybe you can share. To your point, like writing the book, there were so many things after 20 years of doing this work that I wanted to convey to people. Like, number one is that you than me principle, but the essence of my work is breaking down communication into three pillars: content, delivery, presence. With presence being a critical piece to focus on in order to convey the message and create connection. And presence is made up of so many different things. So around the world of presence, and what I hope that people get from my book, it's not meant to be a cover to cover read. You can pick it up and just read one of the strategies. But in the presence pillar and the strategies there, the thing I would love for people to take away is that you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be present. And presence comes when comfort meets authenticity, which requires a bit of self-awareness, other awareness, and room awareness. And the heart of that is curiosity. Curiosity is what drives that, which then enables you to be present in the moment and hold the space and then project the type of presence that you wish to convey.
So it's presence in the sense of being presence, which then leads to projecting one's presence. Is it because when I first heard presence, I was thinking that's around me trying to have gravitas, or you know, trying to create a presence. But actually, it sounds like it's presence comes about as a result of being present in the sense of listening, empathy, really hearing what someone's saying. Is that the case?
I love your approach to this, the idea that I want to come with a sense of gravitas. I want to come with the idea of having a commanding presence in the moment. And what I'm hearing you say is that it has to be grounded in that curiosity. I would agree 100% that it is about showing up in a way that connects authentically with my audience, not just projecting an idea. If I could add a little caveat there, though, there is a need to fake it till you make it. Because we have been conditioned to show up a certain way. We emulate other people and assume the way they're doing it is the way it needs to be done, but it might not be authentic. So there is a point of fake it till you make it in order to try on leading from a different part of ourselves to break out of that conditioning to convey the presence that we want to convey.
Hearing you talk about presence, not perfection, is really interesting for me because, you know, we get to speak to a lot of people on these podcasts from all these different perspectives. And many people say similar things, and some people say things we probably have heard before. But this is a completely new idea for me, I have to say. And I'm loving it, the relationship between curiosity and presence. What I'm hearing you say is I am more engaged and I'm more engaging if I'm, you know, if I'm authentically curious about you and about what the topic is. And that curiosity brought forward is engaging and enables presence, enables people to pay attention to me, a little bit like the story you told about the lady in the tech company. That's great.
Which I think ties to some research I remember seeing. I think it was Harvard research around curiosity leading to improved teamwork. And that was with a view that being curious around other people's points of view. So someone in my team has a completely different point of view from me, rather than taking that as a negative and a sort of an affront, actually being curious around why would they think that, you know, why, what do they know that I don't know? And that curiosity, reducing conflict, creating genuine interest, I guess the empathy, the you then me, and that creating a stronger team dynamic. So I think it feels like it all ties together nicely.
It does tie together. And if I could, like, I want to unpack what Garrett just said about presence, and I want to unpack what you just said about curiosity leading collaboration. In my book, I go into assume positive intent. To your point, Simon, that is such a cliche, assume positive intent, right? I'm a lifelong nomad. I've lived in dozens of countries and dozens of cities. And what I learned is assuming positive intent is not a muscle. I mean, it's not an intuitive, because we are survivalists, we're protected, right? So we're not going to assume it. Learning how to assume positive intent in a diverse culture is what leads to that curiosity that leads to better collaboration. And the way that I offer to anybody out there that's listening how to really embody and exercise assume positive intent is this. Start by asking yourself, when it comes to that person, that culture, that project, what are your thoughts? Where do those beliefs, experiences, thoughts, where do they come from? What are they grounded in? Are they true? Where is the gap? Where is the not true? Where is the question? What is it that you need to learn in order to understand it better? I'll give an example. I have a cell phone carrier here in the United States that I am constantly in friction with. They're constantly changing the rates, changing the things. I'm getting different things on my bill. So every time I call them, I go in with this story of like, and I have to check myself. And what I do is I go back over my story. What is my story about the carrier, customer service in general? I start making a list of what is positive. Well, 99% of the time, I'm doing pretty well with it. And then when I get on the call, I go in with curiosity and more of an open mind. You can do this in the same thing with a team situation. Maybe there's somebody that you have friction with. What's that friction based on? What's the story the person has? Where is your curiosity around it? To create that assume positive intent and then create better collaboration among the team.
So I was reminded as you were talking, so I was doing a session on the book earlier today to a group of leaders. And one of the things as part of that was looking back on was a podcast we did with Warren Berger, who wrote the book, The Most Beautiful Question. He's a questionologist, and he talks about a jugular question, which is why do I believe what I believe? Mm. And what if I'm wrong, as the follow-up one. I think that's a super powerful one. Yeah, what assumptions am I bringing into this? Yeah, that's it, to your point. How do I better collaborate? How do I understand diverse culture? Why do I believe what I believe? Questioning one's own assumptions, and then a follow-up of, yeah, what if I'm wrong?
That is beautiful. The game changer for me was in conversations along the questions like that of what is it I need to learn? What is it I need to learn from this conversation? If I go in with that awareness, I have a more constructive conversation, even when it's difficult or high intensity. I kind of want to go back to presence. Garrett, you brought it up that you haven't thought about it. And one of the questions I have is, when you think of presence, who do you think of? Like, who is it that you say, oh, that person, he or she has presence? Who is it and what is it that they're doing?
Well, I mean, being a musician, I immediately think about a conductor and some of the conductors that I admire. Some of the people like Michael Tilson Thomas, Gustavo Dudamel, for example, even Papano in the UK, or Gurdjieff, who's somebody I don't necessarily get on with. I certainly don't get on with his politics, but I do get on with him as a musician. So the idea of somebody having to come out as an ordinary person and stand in front of a group of professionals, whether they're talking or whether they're conducting, you know, everyone's going to deliver in some way. But then they have to develop an immediate empathy with that group of people. You've really got me thinking, I have to say, Zeltoria, and thank you for that, because what I'm really thinking about is, if I am curious, and if I am curious about the other, curious about who I'm engaging with, even if I disagree with them, or I don't know with them, or I don't think there's somebody that I would get on with, for example, if I stop and I'm curious about something about them or about the situation in an empathetic way, I immediately gain presence. I mean, that talks about it almost like a quantum relationship between us and the other individual. We establish a relationship just from assuming that condition. And that's really got me thinking. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. But back to your question, who does it make me think of in terms of presence? I've spoken about conductors.
Well, first of all, I love the two parts that you brought up. Thank you for that. One, conductors for me too convey presence. When you watch a conductor start, it's very intentional, slow. They bring it all together. They don't whip it up. There's a moment where they're taking in the entire room. And you can see as they walk into and take the stand, there's a moment where they are showing that curiosity. Where is everybody out? Who's not sitting straight that I need to keep a little bit of eye on or keep a little bit closer? Who can I bring in directly to bring into the harmony of the entire group? I think a conductor is a brilliant demonstration of presence. And curiosity. Curiosity is the heart of creating that presence. And I would offer, again, that it can be taught. And the curiosity in the sense of, in my book, I go into self-awareness, other awareness, room awareness. Every situation has those three factors at play in communication. Is your message going to land or not land is determined about self-awareness, other awareness, and room awareness. So once a day, along with the other exercise, set a timer and do a deep dive in curiosity about one of those three perspectives in the situation that you are in. Maybe your alarm goes off and you're in a meeting. You can look around the room and say, how does the lighting in this room affect the way people are interacting? How does the seating affect it? How does the variation, the size of the table, get really curious about the room and how that is impacting the conversation? Once a day, try it about your self-awareness. What do you bring? To develop that curiosity and, to your point, create a greater sense of presence when you're communicating.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
One of the things that I'm really enjoying about our conversation is how practical you make it and how you bring it back to practical cases and things where it's happened. I have a question about one that I know about, where you've supported entrepreneurs and executives preparing for fundraising. And apparently there's a case where the people you were advising overshot their goal by $100 million.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting.
That's a great blunder, if you ask me. What communication and how did comms and presence and how did you enable that? What was that about?
I was in the Bay Area, so I was working both with Y Combinator, a lot of startup founders, a lot of people going to first, second, third round funding. And so it became sort of a curiosity of mine of how to connect their brilliant ideas, their vision, with funders who are going to understand and grasp that vision. There's a pitch formula. We don't need to go into that here, but there is a structure to a pitch that if you follow it, you're going to have more success in leading to the outcomes that you want. That formula amplifies something that a lot of people get wrong. And this is something that I think was critical in that situation. When people tell stories, they often start with the what and not the why. This is what I did. This is what was going on. This is what we did to help them. Oh, let me tell you about the time that I solved this problem. This is how we did it. We need to start with the why. We need to cultivate the reasoning around the pain, the problem that we're solving. Until our listener can relate to, find relevance in that pain, they're not going to care what you did or what your solution is. So the first part of creating an effective pitch is really creating that sense of relevance around the problem and the pain. With that particular case where they overshot their goal by $100 million, there was also a cultural difference. I won't say which, but there was a different country that was pitching to a different country trying to seek the funding. And the high context versus low context cultures came into play. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but the idea of communicating at a level that is appropriate to the context of the situation with that culture, and then also changing the way that a person communicates to meet that culture where they are. So when the team was able to adjust their own cultural conditioning to mirror the cultural conditioning of their stakeholders, and they were able to explain the pain points and build that relevance, boom, they overshot the goal.
And so how much of that was understanding the stakeholder more and the culture of the stakeholder? How much of that was the storytelling and then getting to a strong why? I guess I'm reminded of sort of Simon Sinek's Whip Start with Why and the power of why from many aspects. What were the most powerful parts of, I guess, that? Or was it a combination of all of those that they put into action and that blew the investors away and hence an extra $100 million thrown into the pot?
Yeah, I would love to present you with a template and, hey, follow this and work, but it was individual to each team member. One team member was a very data-driven analyst who wanted to convey all of the data and stop there. So for that person, it was really understanding how to build relevance before dropping and how to develop a conversation. Another person really needed that cultural difference so that they weren't coming across in a culturally inappropriate or a friction way with a new culture. And another person on the team was really about the, it was kind of a combination between the story and the cultural differences. I would love to give you a formula. Unfortunately, every person I have encountered in these 20 years of coaching, over 1,000 people, everybody has a different little nuance. What happens when the spotlight is shown on you? Something comes up that only that individual can start to work with to create a greater sense of connection with their audience.
Hmm. Does your sensitivity to cultural differences and differences amongst people and the empathy, does that come from your lifestyle, which as a digital nomad, for example, is how you characterize yourself? You work with leaders and teams around the world. Has this influenced your perspective on all of this?
I grew up in Kansas, which is in the middle of this United States, very small conservative town, went to a university, and I stayed in the International Hall, exposed to, there were 49 different countries in that hall. It became a thirst I couldn't quench. And so immediately after college, I started traveling around the world for 7 years. And that has informed much of my understanding of communication, noticing, first of all, the difference of how different cultures communicate. And it's not even, you don't have to go across the country. You can go across a country. You don't have to leave the country to experience that. You go from New York to LA. There's a huge difference in the way people are communicating, what they lead with when they start a conversation. It's fascinating to me. So I'm very analytical. And so I was studying how do these different cultures. And then when I learned that there are research around the high and low context, and there's research around how body language is communicated, that infused my passion. And unfortunately, it's still an itch I can't stop scratching. I am stuck on being a nomad, and I probably will the rest of my life. So
do you travel a lot?
Oh, yeah, I'm rarely in a place for more than a couple of weeks.
Amazing. I have a question about curiosity, your personal curiosity. What are you most curious about right now, outside of your work? You know, what is Salvatore curious about?
When you ask the question, what really comes up? I'm in America, and I would say we're going through a difficult time right now, where there's a lot of divisiveness and there's a lack of curiosity between two sides. There's a pitting against each other. And I'm curious how this is going to unfold, when it'll be a breaking point, when the need for protectionism from one side turns into curiosity and support. I have hope that we will get there. And I also feel sadness at what's going on. So that's where I'm curious.
Mm. Do you think you might have some solutions? Not you personally, but do you think there might be some solutions from your communities and people around you?
The number one solution I would offer is you, then me, obviously. But I think the key right now is to not take things personally. One of my coaching techniques for a lot of people who experience fear about speaking in front of groups is to start with not about me. The audience is a reflection, their sour face, that seeming disinterest when they look at their phone, it doesn't have to do with you. It doesn't have to do with you. It doesn't have to do with what you just said. I mean, there's a sliver of possibility, but it doesn't have to do with you. And we internalize that. And I think what's happening right now in America is they're making everything about them. When you stop and ask any American, okay, well, how does that issue impact you and your life personally? They can't answer it. They can only spout the rhetoric that they're hearing on the news channels about how it's impacting our society. And so I think if there was an opportunity for Americans to stop and think, this is not about me. What is about me? Then they could take action to start creating a better society.
So we're coming up at time, but maybe if I just do a quick wrap of the conversation so far. So I loved your opening piece of curiosity as a gateway drug, how it creates that sense of connection and that childlike curiosity, that sense of wonder, how we went through your painful experience of getting up on stage and losing your voice and how that actually inspired curiosity around, you know, what happened. And loved the actually to deal with that going forward. It was the fear of having the spotlight put onto you that actually led to, I want to own the spotlight and be able to sort of own the dialogue and how that addressed that fear. The you, that me, super powerful. And the practical piece of actually, you know, what should we do? We should take that away once a day, challenge ourselves. Let's come up with the three things first about the person that we're dealing with. And then when we're doing that, be very careful around the but. We're only allowed one but per day, that actually it should be the yes and. The three pillars that you have in your book around how it's not dialogue, it's dialogue, not download, and how we need to think about content delivery and presence, and the great conversation we had around presence. And then, but how we assume positive intent, but look at that through also then sort of diverse cultures and what we can away from sort of better collaboration and sort of questioning our own thoughts, which gets back into that sort of juggler question from more on around why do I believe what I believe. Setting a timer and then looking at those three levels of awareness, so self-awareness, other awareness, the lights, the seating, the table, and that sort of room awareness piece. And then going into the power of stories and starting not with what, but starting with why. And then your own personal curiosity around some of the challenges we see. So loads we covered. From all of that, is there one thing that you'd leave our listeners with, Savitri?
I would offer Viktor Frankl's quote, often quoted, is that there is a space between stimulus and response. And in that space is our opportunity to make a choice. Curiosity is at the heart of that. When we become curious about how we instinctively conditioned act or respond to stimulates, we begin to build stronger leadership, stronger connections, stronger teams, and more effective communication all around.
A great way to close. Thank you so much for joining us, Savitri.
Thank you.
Thank you, Savitri. I've learned a huge amount, and I've left me with lots to think about. I'm very grateful.
My pleasure.
This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity and makes this useful for everyone. You've been listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. We're always curious to hear from you, so please do share what you found useful or valuable from this conversation. Do write a review and do click on that 5 stars and follow us on whatever your favorite podcast is. And do check out the book if you want to learn more about the 7 C's. And do also please check out Savitri's book as well. And with that, thank you. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Jessica Wickham.